British Public Radio. Food and Drink.
Hello and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Richard and Joy Morris. They own the award-winning Anchor Hill Vineyard, and we're going to be talking to them about Welsh vineyards. We're going to find out about all the different producers, all 17 of them roughly, the key areas in the Vale of Glamorgan and Monmouthshire, as well as Wales as a wine-producing region and the typical grape varieties grown in Wales.
Italian inmates incarcerated on the tiny island of Gorgona planted a vineyard recently and have now produced 2,700 bottles of white wine, a blend of Vermentino and Ansonica grapes. They have been given wine producing tips by the Frescobaldis, one of Italy's oldest and most respected winemaking families, and have even been given the official DOC appellation, or the Denominazione d'Origine Controllata, the equivalent of France's AOP. The wine is called Frescobaldi per Gorgona. The inmates grow grapes in a corner of the island, which is barely 2 miles long and lies to the north of Elba, the place where Napoleon was exiled by the British, and Giglio, where Costa Concordia capsized last year. They'll not be allowed to sample the wine themselves, though. Instead, it will go on sales to restaurants and wine bars around Italy, starting from next week. Perhaps the guards might want to double-check what's in those wine barrels before they leave the prison.
While vineyard work is hard work, it is also skilled work. You'll hear about Richard talking about winter pruning, etc. in the interview later on. And I think skilled work is perfect for criminals or people who are doing time because it gives them a skill when they come out. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, as Europe's biggest supplier of wine to China, France is obviously keen to sort out any trade dispute it may have with the country. And the French President, François Hollande, has requested a special EU meeting to forge a common stance on the EU's trade row with China. China announced an anti-dumping and anti-subsidy investigation into EU wine on Wednesday. This is thought to be a tit-for-tat move in retaliation for punitive tariffs imposed on Tuesday by the European Union's Executive Commission on Chinese solar exports to the 27-nation bloc. Accusing China of undercutting market prices with state subsidies, Brussels has slapped an 11.8% higher duty on Chinese solar panels, which will rise to an average of 47.6% in August. While France supported the action, the move was opposed by Germany and a number of other EU member states, which fear for their booming trade with the Asian economic powerhouse.
I'm amazed when I look around the world at the punitive trade barriers that are in place in many countries. India is a classic one. Heavy duties on imported wines compared to locally produced wines. I thought that being a member of the World Trade Organization stopped this, but France is in a difficult position. They may be able to justify handouts to their farmers under many guises, but France does subsidize farmers to stay on the land. French wines are cheaper because of it. So France's future wine in China may be in doubt, but their history is becoming more clear. What's the next story, Jane?
Finally this week, archaeologists have found evidence that France's passion for winemaking may have started in the south of France as early as 5th century BC. Items were found in the ancient coastal town of La Tara, one of the best preserved Iron Age sites in France, located about 125 kilometres west of Marseille. Chemical analysis of these artefacts revealed that wine was being produced at that time. The study, led by the University of Pennsylvania, found tartaric acid, which occurs in grapes, in all of the jars they found, strong evidence that they once contained wine. The analyses also revealed the characteristic fingerprints of pine resin, as well as herbs such as rosemary and basil, which may have served as flavourings or preservatives, or been added to give the wine medicinal properties. A limestone platform dated to about 425 to 400 BC also carried tartaric acid residues. Archaeologists had once thought it might have been used for pressing olives, but the platform looks remarkably similar to a grape press depicted on a piece of Greek pottery from around the same time. That's all from me this week. Don't forget to check these stories out at our website 3050.co.uk.
Other recent archaeological evidence has shown that France has most likely learnt how to make wine from the Italians, and they learnt from further east, Greece, and they probably learnt by further east as well, as the knowledge of winemaking moved from east to west. At the London International Wine Conference, I attended an interesting presentation by Gert de Verres from KPMG, and he talked about preventing wine fraud. And it just got me thinking about it. Now, counterfeiting is thought to be worth around $663 billion worldwide for all products, with alcohol worth around $1 billion annually, according to a published report by the FBI and Interpol. Counterfeiting has a number of faces. There's counterfeiting, tampering, and brand extensions. Counterfeiting is pretty obvious. It's simply the process of producing a product and pretending it's another. Hardy Rodenstock was considered a master of this, creating fake bottles, including a 1787 Chateau Lafite Bordeaux, supposedly owned by Thomas Jefferson. The bottles, and even the initials of Thomas Jefferson, were from the outset counterfeit. Proven later that they were faked when a microscopic analysis of the TJ initials on each bottle proved that they were cut with a modern-day Dremel. Rudy Kerwan, the Indonesian wine collector who in 2007 was thought to be the owner of arguably the greatest cellar on earth, is now thought to be a mixture of counterfeiter and tampering. He brought empty bottles from restaurants and refilled them, and it is thought that he even changed the dates on some wines so that they went from being a wine that's not quite worth as much to a wine from a vintage that's worth an awful lot. That said, when he was arrested, he did have a major stockpile of ink and paper used for forgery, so he was probably a bit of both tampering and counterfeiting. Brand extensions is when someone makes a fictitious wine that does not exist. Perhaps a Hardy's Nero d'Avola. But brand extensions are less of an issue in wine. Although that said, I'm sure there's a number of corkscrews and other wine paraphernalia that sports the name of a famous producer without a licensing agreement in place. If the wine is counterfeit, then both the producer and the drinker miss out. The producer, because they have lost the value of the sale, and there's a chance that the wine will give the brand a poor reputation. But no producer wants to tell the world not to drink its wine because it's a bad forgery. So there's a natural tendency for producers to cover the story up. Also, if you ask an auction house, and I have asked auction houses about forgeries in the past, they will normally tell you there is no problem here, nothing to see, move along. But it's very unlikely that they will tell you a problem, even if there is one, as this will discredit themselves. So I would recommend you never take assurances that forgery is not a problem, because hardly anybody ever says it is. Certainly no one's selling wines anyway. The consumer is also lost because they're drinking something that may not be as good as one hoped. That said, a good forger can and does get away with duplicity more often than not. After all, it's been shown time and time again, a higher price makes a wine taste better, even when compared to the same wine when people think it's cheaper. So, you may not be drinking what you think, but at the very least, you'll probably enjoy it more than the £5 bottle of wine that it really is. There are a number of ways of fraud detection, including examining the labels, tracing provenance, and chemical analysis. Many counterfeited bottles use modern paper and ink, so a careful examination of the label, capsule and cork, and even the bottle shape can, to the trained eye, spot a fraud. Auction houses often have huge stocks of photos that they use to compare bottles. The main problem with the older wines is that bottling at the winery or chateau is a relatively new phenomena, with many older wines bottled by the importer or retailer and each with their own label. While it may seem strange, it is possible to tell if a wine was made before 1939 and the exact vintage after 1939. This is because the Americans and everybody else seem to be detonating nuclear bombs in the atmosphere, and that resulted in a change in the atom carbon-14. It's an isotope of carbon. Plants absorb both the carbon-14 and the normal carbon-12, depending on what year they're grown. In fact, it's possible to know the vintage of the wine by looking at the level of carbon-14 in it. The problem with this type of testing, while it's very good for spotting vintage variation, it won't tell you if it's a forgery from another producer, but from that vintage, a lesser wine perhaps. And more importantly, the only way of knowing for sure is by chemical analysis, which means you've got to take the cork out, which means you might as well drink it. The value is gone. Opening the cork up ruins the value of a bottle of wine that you want to keep for investment. But recent frauds have shown that even mainstream, more value-oriented wines have been forged. In the UK, fake Jacob's Creek wines have been seized in off-licenses, with fake bottles appearing identical to the actual Jacob's Creek, apart from a misspelling on the back label. So it's easier to forge a modern wine. Many anti-fraud mechanisms are what they call one-way. That is, a mark is applied to the wine, which is to indicate that it's not a forgery. This may be micro dots on the label, metallic bands that appear in the paper, special papers, etc. The problem is it requires someone who knows what to look for and assumes that the technology cannot be copied, which It eventually can be. You've got to think about the arms race involving counterfeiters of £20 banknotes in the Bank of England. Notes are only in circulation for 5 to 10 years, and then you can increase the level of fraud protection, change the pattern, etc. But wines are around for 20 to 50 years plus, and as a result, the likelihood of the technology changing make it easier to forge is going to be more and more likely. One modern way of managing fraud is by two-way communication. The wine has a mark which is communicated back to the producer. An example of being used in a number of products, particularly in medicine, is QR codes that have a unique code per bottle. This is done in a number of areas and can be used by companies to improve fraud protection and identify where in the supply chain it is occurring. Enforcement officers can turn up at a shop and check each wine on the shelves by scanning it and identifying which is valid and destroying the forgeries. QR codes are particularly useful when wines and beverages are sold in one market and illegally imported into another market. This may be because of differential pricing, as happens with luxury goods, or to avoid duty. By giving each bottle a unique QR code, a customer with a smartphone can enter a competition by submitting a QR code, giving the location of where it was purchased. Forged wines will have duplicate QR codes or none at all. So a duplicate QR code tells the brand owner where the forgery was purchased. This can be used to shut down shops selling forged or illegally imported goods. And this two-way communication can also be used for more expensive wines, so a central server can understand and provide the provenance of each wine and its unique QR code. Forgery is a growing problem in the wine trade, and it's of epidemic proportions in some regions of the world. The move to two-way communications about a wine can improve the provenance of the wine and help track down breakdowns in the supply chain. It is being implemented in the EU for medical supplies, and it's only time before some form of two-way communication is common for wine. I thought the presentation I went to was quite interesting about QR codes. I was expecting something slightly different, actually, but I was quite pleased sitting in on it because it lets you think about forgery as, you know, all these marks that are on the wine, they're not really that useful. Two-way communication may be the solution to forgeries going forward. One winery that isn't in the Forger site well at the moment anyway is Anchor Hill Estates. Joy Richard Morris from Anchor Hill Vineyard, right on the Welsh-England border, but definitely in Wales, and we're going to talk a wee bit about Welsh wines. How are you guys?
Yeah, we're fine, thanks.
We were talking a wee bit earlier that you're saying your climate's actually almost continental where you are, but I always think of Wales as, you know, pretty wet, and I presume that's more to the west coast. So, but where... how many producers are there in Wales and where are they located?
Most of the vineyards in Wales are in South Wales. There are six.
Near Cardiff or?
Yeah, the sort of Vale of Glamorgan, which is west of Cardiff. There are quite a few.
Yeah.
There are six in Monmouthshire, which probably says more about our climate than anything else.
Mm-hmm. How many in total in Wales do you think?
We think about 17.
17.
Yeah, but there's a couple in Anglesey in North Wales. I think there's a new one being planted near Wrexham as well. I can't remember the name of the vineyard. There's a very good vineyard in Newtown called Penarth Vineyard. They make some very nice sparkling wine. So the areas really which lend themselves to, from a climate point of view, to growing vines in Wales really is the what we call the border country. Between England and Wales, Monmouthshire and the Vale of Glamorgan. Those are the sort of key growing areas.
Okay. And 17 producers. So not a massive amount. You know, if you think about it, England's got almost as many producers as New Zealand now.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Although I think New Zealand producers are a bit bigger. What sort of, you guys are what, almost 10 acres here, aren't you?
Yeah, we're 10 acres. I looked at some stats actually for the Welsh government some 2 years ago, and approximately Wales are producing in a good year about 100,000 litres of wine, which is about 2-3% of the whole of the British production. So relatively small compared to England.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And is it mainly consumed locally, or I noticed that you guys export to England. You call it exporting? Throw a bottle over the border. But
yeah, they drink it with Coke over there.
do you guys, is it all consumed locally, or as you know, I imagine, you know, people are quite patriotic, you know, even in the UK, there's a lot of its internal consumption.
Yes, our biggest market is Wales, for that very reason, you know, people are very patriotic, and the fact that they can buy a decent wine that's made in Wales is very important.
Yeah.
But it's, we get a cross section of people, really. We get a lot of holiday makers. We're in a holiday area.
Tourist area.
So we get a lot of tourists come to the vineyard and take the wine home with them to various places. And we are getting more, suppliers in England. So it's the whole of the UK really is our market.
And Richard was saying earlier that you've even got a supplier in Melbourne, Australia, taking a couple of cases.
We have, yes. I don't think it's going to be our major
supplier. just for any Australian listeners, who would they get your wines from in Australia?
It's in Auburn.
Melbourne. It is Auburn Cellars, I think. Isn't
Auburn
it?
Cellars, that's right. Cellars. Auburn Cellars in Melbourne.
Yeah. Big plug for them here.
Yeah. Wayne liked. So if you're listening, Wayne, keep on selling the wine, buddy.
Another pellet's coming out.
Yeah.
Fantastic. In England, there's the English Wine Producers, which is a sort of almost like a marketing board for English wine. And I understand that the reason originally there was no UK wine producers was because Wales had already had their sort of own marketing board when the English Wine Producers was set up. So they said, well, we'll deal with England. You guys deal with Wales then. But you're saying earlier, Richard, that the Welsh marketing board, whatever it's called, doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, no, I don't even know how long ago that was, but no, it doesn't. Welsh vineyards are in the main part of the Southwest Vineyard Association, which is obviously also part of the United Kingdom Vineyard Association. We haven't got our own representative body at the moment. It is being looked at. I think the Welsh government are possibly very keen. They're one of the key areas that they're trying to develop in Wales, apart from tourism, is the food and drinks industry. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, obviously, developing the Welsh wine industry, particularly on the back of, if I can say that, some of the successes we've had in terms of some of the awards we've won, is obviously quite attractive. So we have actually got a meeting of Welsh vineyards towards the end of this month, which is April, to get together and see how we can work together more and have more of a Welsh representation within the UK and also from a worldwide point of view, of course.
Yeah, and I understand you're actually going to there's the English wine trade tasting in
9th of May.
9th of May coming up, and I understand you guys are going to have your wines there as well.
Yeah, we are this year. Yeah, it's the first year we've been.
I've never seen any Welsh wine there in the past.
I think you're probably right. So
keep an eye out for your bottles, which I must admit, particularly your sparkling wine, very nicely designed labels. Who designed that?
A bit of a joint effort, really. Mostly David and me, with some input from Richard.
And a guy called James, who works for Gigantic Designs in London. So
we gave him our ideas and he put them into the form that you can see. So
nice clean labels.
I'm very pleased with them.
Yeah, your rosé bottle, your sparkling rosé bottle, is a really nice looking bottle in terms of the colour and the way the label works, because it's quite a clear label. Quite like it, actually. So, what are the main grape varieties grown in Wales? You know, you guys are trying Albarino and Triomphe and Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and grubbed up your Sauvignon Blanc. So,
I think most of the vineyards are growing some of the older German varieties. You know, like
Reichensteiner
and Dornfelder and some Sauvignon, of course. But they're increasingly, I think, as people develop their vineyards, they are beginning to look to plant the classic Champagne varieties of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, a little bit of Pinot Meunier as well. We've got some Meunier here. Okay. So, you know, White Castle, just up the road from us, for example, I know they've planted Pinot.
Is there a move to the sparkling wines? You know, because in England, everybody's just jumping in on sparkling wines.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, if England and Wales are going to get a reputation for producing world-class wines, it's going to be sparkling wines, definitely, because the climate suits. And, you know, things like Pinot and Chardonnay are cool climate varieties. And as long as you've got the right little miso climate in the UK, then they will grow very well here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In England, a lot of people talk about the whale weald, you know, with the chalk soils and all that, although some of the better wines aren't on chalk. Is there chalk here, or is there any particular soils that dominate the area?
Well, we've got a clay loam soil, but we have got a lot of limestone, which obviously helps with drainage.
Yep.
And
heat retention.
Heat retention as the stones come to the surface.
Yep. Clay is quite a nasty one for working vineyards. So.
If you've got too much clay, but we've got a very nice balance. There's a small amount of clay, but it's mainly a loam soil.
Okay, because clay gives a richness to wines often.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does give the flavour, as does limestone. It's very similar to the type of soil you've got in Chablis, for example. It's heavier, definitely heavier. But it's that type of you taste our Chardonnay, for example, which is not dissimilar from a slightly oaked Chablis, for example.
It's probably doesn't quite have the nose intensity on the nose, but the structure on the mouth, but possibly a bit richer actually on the mouth.
Yeah,
not in alcohol, but just in fruit weight.
So
that might be Lee's aging, though. Quite sure, or Lee's work.
I think in Wales as well as England, that the future is going to be Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, with the emphasis on sparkling wines.
Yep. Is there much planting going on in Wales? Like you're looking to expand, double in size, but
not as far as we know. I think it's still something that a lot of people think, you can't grow vines in Wales.
Yeah.
And obviously it is very site specific. So, I think it'll be a more limited planting in Wales than in England, but,
I think that might develop. The Welsh government are, interested in seeing how it could be developed. And, Pinot Noir, for example, where good quality Pinot, you can get up to £3,000 a ton. And if you're getting a yield of 2-3 tons an acre in a really good year, as a diversified cash crop for farmers, as long as on the right sort of slopes, right sort of mesoclimate, which I keep on going on about, I think there are some very interesting opportunities actually. So it's something I think that will develop, but it's going to take a few years to educate and research, I think.
Richard, you went to Plumpton along with David.
Yeah. Not at the same time, but
Is there any viticultural courses that you can do in Wales, or is everything done through Plumpton?
It's all done through Plumpton, yeah. Plumpton is the leading viticulture and enology school in the UK, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any others? I only know Plumpton.
Yeah, I think Cirencester Agricultural College do some sort of...
They do a wine marketing.
Yeah, it's course. More on the sort of marketing side, and So no, there isn't really. It is the place to go. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you got to still get out to England occasionally. How do you feel? How about feel about paying the toll back and forth?
Well, at least we pay to come home.
Yes.
I was actually thinking about this. Sounding a bit rude, but I was thinking about it. It's like you don't really want to pay, have a fee to leave the country. You want to pay to get in. You know. It's like,
yeah,
that sends the right signal.
They've got it the right way around, the government, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering why you didn't. Where does that money go? Does it go to Wales or does it go to the English government?
From the bridge.
I think it goes to the owner of the bridge.
Oh, is it private bridge?
It's a private bridge. The old Severn Bridge is a private bridge, and I think the new one is as well. So I think the government, to my knowledge, can control how they increase the tolls. You know, there's a certain agreement, but yeah.
And at the moment, you're getting your grapes made in Three Choirs. Does that mean it can't be called Welsh wine, or because
no, you can still call it Welsh wine.
Even though it's been made in another country.
Even though it's been made in another country. Yeah. But you know, when we've got our winery, touch wood, then you know, as David said earlier, we'll be able to make the wine biodynamically as well, and using concrete and wood and oak rather than stainless steel, and longer ferments and more natural ferments, and so it'll be a different style of wine. So. And we'll have the control on how we make it, of course.
What about some of the changes with regards to, I suppose the old word was appellation, but these days it's more PDOs and, is it PDOs and
PGIs? PGIs, yeah. You know, Welsh wine has got to follow the same process because it's part, we're part of the UKVA. From a personal point of view, I think it's over bureaucratic, hasn't always been well thought out, and largely unnecessary in my view. But rules are rules, and we're part of the EU, and that's the world we live in.
So your wines don't say PGI on the bottle, or not that I noticed, anyway.
Not the ones you've seen at the moment, because all the wines you've drunk today have been 2009, 2010, and 2011. But moving forward, our labelling is going to have to adjust to the new regulations.
And how does that apply? How do the regulations apply to you?
Just in terms of what you put on the legal requirements of what you put on the label.
And which are?
For example, depending on whether it's a PDO or a PGI, it's what you can call it, whether you can refer to the, whether you can call it a Cornish wine or a Welsh wine, for example, whether you call it a quality wine. And there's certain wordings that you've got to use depending on whether you're making a table wine or whether you're making a regional wine or a quality wine.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% au fait with the rules at the moment because I haven't actually had to address that. Yeah. And we'll be getting advice through the Wine Standards Board, for example, exactly giving examples of what you've got to put on your label and everything. And we'll have to make our decision at that time on what category of wine we're going to go for, whether it's PDO or PGI.
What's PDO and PGI stand for again?
PGI is Product Geographical Indicator, and PDO is Product Denomination of Origin, I think.
Yeah, so PDO is like the Appellations, and PGI is what more like Van der Pays.
And you can still make a table wine, of course, and avoid being in that category. So where what you put on the label is more relaxed. So it's a choice we're going to have to look at, really. But it just means more wording on the label. So the label, the legal label, just gets a bit more cluttered.
On the back label.
Yeah, we use the back label as the legal label. There's no legislation on whether it's got to be the main front label or the back label.
Yeah.
Whether it helps the public decide more discerningly on what they're drinking, I doubt it very much.
I don't think it does. I think it makes it more confusing for people.
Yeah.
You know, because...
Well, I, to be honest, I'm in the wine trade and I'm a bit confused by it all, so...
It almost makes it that you've got to have a certain amount of knowledge before you know what you're buying, and I think that's really not a good thing.
I think it's just jobs for the boys, civil servants in Brussels and elsewhere who need something to do, and this is one of the targets, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Although there's nothing wrong with harmonisation, you know, I think that there's advantages.
No. Yeah.
And the systems were, each European country had their own system, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
That might make things a bit more easier.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. Do the French ever follow EU laws? Sorry, that's a bit controversial, perhaps. But
I'm just
thinking about, you know, when you go and buy cheese from a nice little shop in France and, you know, does it come straight out of the fridge? No, it's been sitting outside for 3 hours maturing, and that's why it tastes nicer. But strictly speaking, you're not allowed to do it.
Okay. You sell Welsh cheese here, don't you?
We don't sell cheese, but we do Welsh cheese platter lunches.
Yeah.
So, there are some very, very good Welsh cheeses around. So, as we're a Welsh producer, we decided to use.
Have you
Welsh
looked
produce.
At matching your wines to the cheeses? Do you match the wines to the cheeses?
Yes. Obviously, some of the wines go better with some of the cheese than others. And whoever comes for lunch is, you know, they choose which wine they want. Mm-hmm. So the sparklings aren't as good a match with the cheese. But if you like sparkling wine and that's what you want, then that's what you have.
Yeah, so I'm very much the 80% of food goes with 80% of wine, and 10% is fantastic, 10% is a disaster. So as long as you can avoid the disasters, you're pretty safe. We were talking earlier about you guys expanding and looking for new vineyard sites. Do you see yourself growing continuously, or is there a natural size you want to get to? Or
yeah, the natural size is sort of 18 to 20 acres. We feel we've got spare capacity at the moment. There's David and myself who run the vineyard, and we've got Carolyn who works for us full time. Joy spends a lot more time on the cellar door and the selling and marketing, etc. And we feel up to 20 acres, which is doubling the size we've currently got, we can cope with because we've got all the machinery and everything. We feel we can handle more pruning, etc. But we think anything above that, we would start losing control. because we feel at the moment we can give every single vine, if you like, individual attention. And biodynamics is a lot more labor intensive. To go beyond 20 acres, you're basically going to have to just start employing more people, and that's just going to erode your margins. So in terms of maximizing margins and maximizing quality, we think 18, 20 acres is about right.
That's an economic limit as opposed to a lifestyle limit, or is it a bit of both?
It's definitely lifestyle limit as well, because we do have a super lifestyle at the moment. But, you know, very strongly an economic financial, to maximize your bottom line. Mm-hmm. It's at 20 acres. We're going to be maximizing our bottom line.
But I think anything more than that, then you lose the ability to keep an eye on the vineyard, so that any potential problems are noticed before they develop.
Yeah.
Anything over 20 acres, I think, would be a lot more difficult.
And I think you start getting qualitative issues as well. You know, just take pruning, for example. It doesn't sound very technical, but, you know, pruning correctly is very, very important. So if we went beyond 20 acres, you've got to have more permanent staff. They're only pruning for 3 months a year. Yeah. So what do you do with them for the other 9 months a year? Yet you've got to train them to a very high standard. If three of you can handle 20 acres as well as 10 acres, then you're fine, because the three of you have got lots of other work other times of the vineyard.
Yeah, and you're not looking necessarily for seasonal workers coming in.
Not for pruning, no, yeah. Definitely not for pruning, because it's a very specialised technical job.
Joy mentioned the sparkling wines aren't a good match for cheese as other wines. I tend to disagree with her. Goat's cheese is a classic match, but one of my favourites is thinly sliced Parmesan with wines that have got quite a bit of autolysis to them. Yeah, and you can tell the wines that have got autolysis, they're the wines that have got those yeasty, bready notes. And when you develop those yeasty, bready notes, usually the wine's lying on the dead yeast is releasing amino acids and glutamates into the wine, and it's the glutamates / umami that go really nicely with the glutamates and salt from the Parmesan. Right, just to finish up, and this week's quote is from Dean Martin, and he says, "If you drink, don't drive. Don't even putt." Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a British Public Radio presentation in association with the wine tasting company 3050. For more, go to 3050.co.uk.